Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 85th episode of The Psych Files. 85th, and by the way, we just passed year two of The Psych Files. It's been going strong here. So, episode 85, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Eugene Geist about how to make learning fun again. And, you know, by the way, if this topic, you're thinking, well, you know, I'm not terribly interested in that. This is a little bit about democratic schools and Piaget and constructivism. And you say, I don't know. There's a bit in here that I think is interesting that goes beyond just talking about the school environment. And that is when he talks about the way that students are perceived in a school like this. And I was in a meeting recently a couple weeks ago at work, and we were sitting around one of those big C-shaped table, and we were talking about this, you know, it's not important to get into the details, but something that needed to be done at the company, changes that needed to be made. And at one point someone said that, I don't forget the exact quote, but it was something like, of course, employees will have to be properly incented in order to get them to participate in this. Now, what that communicates is a philosophy, really, that employees will not do something unless they are rewarded for doing so. And it sort of made me think about a bit of the history of industrial organizational psychology. Go back about 100 years, and that might be called scientific management. I mean, an example of that, and names like Frederick Taylor come to mind. And there was this era in the early part of last century where and this was when jobs were mostly assembly line kinds of things. And the thought was, well, why don't we just apply scientific principles to the design of work? And so we very carefully examined every job to see how it could be done more efficiently. And that means that you may have heard of time and motion studies, right? Where someone, a scientist, would observe a worker and time their work to see how it could be done faster. And actually, a couple years ago, I was in a musical called The Pajama Game. I don't know if you've ever seen that show. A little dated, perhaps, but some good music. In any case, I played a character named Heinz, or sometimes referred to as Heinzy. He was a time study man, always walking around with his clock and always concerned about efficiency. So this kind of orientation towards either employees or students is kind of we identify with a behavioristic orientation. The only motivators are external ones. So it kind of ties into extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation, which was an episode that I did a while back. And I think if you go to the site and do a search on intrinsic or extrinsic, you'll find that episode. And in that episode, I talked about whether or not we should reward students for reading books. Is that the way to go? So check that out. I thought that was an interesting topic there. So as I sat in the meeting, I thought to myself, all right, you know, I understand that what we were talking about that needed to be done in the company was not the most interesting stuff, although it would definitely cut down on inefficiency and therefore waste. And of course, every organization is concerned about how to do things more efficiently and save costs instead of, you know, laying people off. So I guess I wondered, what was the other side of that thought process? Do we motivate employees to participate in this effort through incentives, or is there a way to involve them in these discussions? What if we were to get more and more of the employees involved? Now, you know, you might say, oh, it just gets so messy at this point. What are we going to do? You know, we've got thousands of employees. How do we manage something like that? And these are the same kind of questions that Dr. Geist is going to address in just a minute, because when we talk about something pretty radical, as I say to him in the episode, although maybe it's not that radical after all, but the idea that to let students have a say in what they want to learn. Now, here you might just say, well, that's even more ridiculous because students are so young and they don't know what they need to learn. Okay, you know, interesting thought. So, you know, if you might just take a listen to what Dr. Geist has to say, see if your mind has changed on that front. But I think anytime we talk about things like how do we get people to change their behavior or to learn, we're talking about or we invoke these two perspectives in psychology, one of which is very behavioral, where we reward people, and the other is a bit more intrinsic and participatory. And so in the last episode, we talked about Piaget, and now we'll go into it further and talk about democratic schools. Maybe you haven't heard about democratic schools. Very interesting. Encourage you to take a listen. I think you will enjoy this. Okay, and then hang around for the end of the episode. Got a few announcements and a promo code, which I think you'll find useful. So I will see you then at the other side of the interview. But for now, here's Dr. Eugene Geist.
There's a good deal of research that shows that children that are taught using a more constructivist method of instruction do just as well on the tests as the kids that are taught the exact information that's on the test, because they actually remember and comprehend and understand the information more. I also tell my teachers that, my future teachers, that even though there are standards and there are things that are going to be on the test that you know about, you can still decide how you present that knowledge. And there's still ways that you can develop a lesson plan that allows you to step back and not give them the information, but still facilitates the learning. It's hard not to give the answer to a student. And many times it just doesn't feel right to them. And so that just takes practice. Instead of giving them the answer or saying that's right or that's a good job, asking them questions about, well, how did you do that? Well, how did you get that answer? How do you think that that's right? Or even having two children discuss something, if they disagree, having them discuss, and instead of taking a side, just asking questions so that they continue that discussion until they get that out. There are a number of programs. One of the ones that I can think of off the top of my head is the Reggio Emilia approach of preschools, which originated in Italy, and many people still go over there and visit the schools in this region of Italy.
Now, how is that spelled again?
R-E-G-G-I-O-E-M-L-I-A, I believe.
Reggio?
E-M-I-L-I-A. Reggio Emilia.
E-M-I, probably
L-I-A, I believe. There was an exhibit that was called the 100 Languages of Children that toured the country that showed some of the things that the children did. And the approach is being adopted in the United States in a number of preschool programs. But the idea is that the children are allowed to make some decisions, to use artwork to represent their knowledge, to think about things, and the teachers step back and do questioning techniques. It's a very nice model of the way that children can do things, and there are some nice examples of work that they've done.
Interesting. So the teacher's role is to use these questioning techniques.
Right. It's more as a facilitator. They will arrange the environment. They will set things up for the children. They will ask questions. They will encourage interaction with objects and other people. And the other thing is that the teachers would then also have meetings after school and talk about, you know, this is what the children are doing. What do we need to do to support that? Where do we need to go with this next? I think that sometimes our teachers today get so tunnel visioned on what they have planned that they don't always address the individual needs of a student. They always have the kind of the same thing for each student to do. So that is one of the things that that I think teachers, it's hard for teachers to break out of. They feel like, I've got so many kids and I've got to do these types of things.
Yeah, I can hear them saying that that it's just not practical to have students at different levels within their classroom.
Right. It is a lot more work for a teacher to do some of this stuff because they have to know each child. They have to know what they're ready for. They have to know how to accommodate each of the children. You know, a nice way to do this is by using projects in the classroom. I often tell people, you know, what you can do is pick a topic that children want to study, like for airplanes or something, and let them take the project where you don't have it planned out, where you say, okay, today we're going to learn about this about airplanes, and tomorrow we're going to learn about this and this, but rather ask the children, say, what do you want to know about airplanes, and how do you want to learn about it, and how do you want to demonstrate your knowledge? And generally what happens when you ask children those questions is that the a project or a unit that might have been 2 weeks if the teacher planned it turns out to be like 4 weeks long, and children learn about airplanes or whatever the topic is in a lot of depth, which by many accounts is missing in our educational system. We learn a lot of things, but not very deeply. We learn a little bit about things, then we move on.
Right.
And what happens, I think another thing with constructivist education, and especially with using projects, is that children have a chance to learn about something in depth and really learn everything there is to know about whatever it is.
But that's not the way schools are set up. I mean, you're not covering enough material if you do that.
Right. It's right. It's not. And that kind of brings us to this the democratic schools, because, again, one of the ways that I kind of shock my students into seeing that this is something that can be done is to show them or to give them the example of the democratic schools, because it is so foreign to anything that they know of what a school is. A democratic schools, each democratic school is different, but basically students have a choice to go to class. They don't have to go to classes if they don't want to. There are lectures and there are classes, but the students have a lot of say in what they do and how they create their knowledge. And more importantly, or probably most importantly to many people in the democratic education movement, is that it's a community where everything is voted on and everybody has an equal vote, including the teachers and the children. And so they would have a school meeting where they would discuss issues. Like, the rules for the school are all developed in that meeting. And since the students outnumber the teachers, the students are the ones that are coming up with things. And the teachers are just another democratic voice. They don't have any more power or any less power than anybody else in the room or anybody else at the school.
Gene, that's pretty radical.
I know, and that's exactly what all of my students say. They say, well, you know, I don't see how students would go to school if they didn't have to. If they didn't have to go to class, I don't see why they would go to class, and I don't see how.
Yeah, they're going to vote to sit around and eat chocolate.
Yeah, and that's what they say. Well, yeah, that's what kids would do. They just vote to spend all the money on chocolate and sit around and eat it.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing is that is not what happens. That these schools, and they've been around for a really long time, and they do work. They work very well. You know, the children and the students and the teachers, they don't just vote to eat chocolate. They actually make rules that are meaningful to them. Actually, have more rules than any other school, because since you are basically being controlled by a rule of law, you have to know what the rules are, and it has to be written down so that everybody lives by the same rules. Whereas in a normal school, you might have just a few rules because there's going to be an authority figure that's going to come and tell you
right.
What the other rules are. You know, that some rules aren't written down. It's just, you know, the teacher just makes it up. You know, you're not allowed to do that. Well, how do you know? Well, because I'm the teacher and I said you can't do that. In a democratic school, you know, you can't do that because one person has no more power than anybody else. So the thing is that these schools do work, and we do see that, you know, since they've been around for a long time, that a lot of very famous people, a lot of highly trained PhD physicists and psychologists have gone to schools like this and have lived very good academic lives, doctors, lawyers, teachers.
Yeah, you know, I can imagine, just again from my experience as a parent, that I know my kids are, of course, they love it when school is canceled, which, by the way, it happens to be today because of the snow. So they're all excited, right? Oh, yay, we get to stay home. But after, and so they're watching something on TV or something, but they get bored and they want to do things. And so they go out and maybe they look for friends or something. And if they're not around, then they try to play something. But they, you know, then they get frustrated. And then my kids, because I have two of them, start to pick on each other. And it's just so clear that they really don't like that boredom at all. And I can imagine that if you let kids make the rules, that maybe they would say, hey, let's just sit around and eat and watch TV. And I'll bet you what would happen is after a while, they'd get really bored with that.
Yeah, and the human mind is meant to be active. It's a biological necessity for us to survive that our brains need to be active. And just think about it, what we do as adults. If we're sitting around, we do a crossword puzzle, or we, you know, do the crypto quip or in the newspaper. Right. Our brains have to be active. But we assume that children don't want to learn, that we have to motivate them to learn, or we have to require them to be at school. And you know, that I think we need to examine that assumption, because it's ingrained in every teacher and every parent that we have to do that. But it's not necessarily the case, and I think that that's what democratic schools tell us, is that students can, when given a responsibility, they might not know everything that they need to know. They might not know calculus, but they do have a desire to learn. They might not want to learn everything, but they get to choose what they want to learn. You know, if they want to be a doctor, obviously there are some certain things that they have to do. Or a teacher would say, okay, well, if you want to be a doctor, these are the things you have to do. You need to take these tests, and you need to do this, and you need to do that. So it's not just that they don't take tests and they just sit around and they just, you know, examine whatever, but rather that they have to think for themselves what they want to do and how they're going to achieve those goals.
Right, right. You know, I think after they've, quote-unquote, sat around and they experience conflicts with other kids, and then they start realizing that there's a need for rules, that they would actually finally come up with more rules than, as you say, the teacher or the school might have in place.
Right, and it's an empowerment. Again, going back to what we talked about with the kids sitting and waiting for me to tell them the answer to a question or to tell them what to do. Here, they don't do that. You want to do something, you want to make a rule, then at the school meeting, you raise your hand and say, hey, this is a rule that I think we should have, and let's discuss it. And that's where the democratic schools come from. They're empowered, just like anybody else in a democracy, to have one vote and one voice in what goes on. And if nobody else agrees with them, then it's not going to be enacted. But it's not one person dictating and saying, okay, I've decided this is what's going to happen.
Okay, so many people would say, oh, you know, this definitely sounds good, that children have to learn to be problem solvers today. Children need to be able to think and be curious and solve problems. So you've talked a bit about how you can, as a teacher, throw some of these ideas into your classroom, even though our classrooms are structured very much like, you know, our industrial society, like, you know, assembly lines and all that. I mean, our schools are just, that's that,
right,
that long history of, we turn children out like we turn out cars. So democratic schools are this sort of offshoot, kind of radical. You know, what do you have hope that our assembly line schools are going to begin to move in a more democratic direction?
Well, I would hope. I mean, I like to be optimistic, and I think that the place that we have to start is with teachers and parents. And I think that if we can get over just the simple, it's almost a knee-jerk reaction when I show a video of a democratic school, it's almost a knee-jerk reaction. That can't work. But when you start talking about it and you say, well, you know, what is it that can't work? What is it that you don't like about this? It's more of an emotional feeling that they have rather than a logical thought. And I think what we have to do is just to try to address some of these issues logically and allow teachers and parents to think about these things in a way that is non-emotional, to say, you know, this is going to be best for your child. And I think it's easy to convince a teacher or a parent that, yes, this is going to be good for my child. But then what comes in is where they say, oh, well, but I can't do it because, and then they start throwing up all sorts of barriers why we can't do it. And I think we have to just try to systematically knock down some of those barriers. And some of that is going to be a grassroots effort, and some of that really needs to be from a governmental barrier. Instead of putting up more barriers of testing and things like that, kind of saying, okay, we understand we need testing, but here's also what we need. We also need to have, you know, some of these types of things. So I like to be optimistic. I think we need to start with the teachers and the parents, because that's where things are going to grow up from, and just keep plugging away at that.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Just keep plugging away. I mean, do you go around and talk to schools or parents or I mean, how does one become an advocate of democratic approaches to schooling?
I do go and talk to teachers and go to conferences, and I do in-service trainings for schools and write some articles trying to give people ways to do some of these things in a more democratic way, or a way that's a little more beneficial for children's intellectual health. But I think, you know, sometimes that you can't always reach everybody that way, because there are some people that think they already know it all, and so they're not going to even come to those types of things. Sometimes I do get, you know, demoralized by some of the things that I see on TV, and, you know, in the way that our school systems and things are going. But I think that if we keep training teachers, and if we keep just trying to put teachers out there in the classrooms that that have a love for children and really want what's best for kids, that we can make a change.
Well, you have certainly made a very convincing argument here.
Oh, I hope so. I hope that this makes some change in people's thoughts about the way we treat our children and the way that we teach our children.
Well, a lot of people will hear it, so I'll be curious to see what kinds of responses they give us.
Yeah, it'd be great.
All right, so no one should walk away feeling confused about what constructivism is, then, finally.
I hope not. I'm still confused about what constructivism is, so if I do that, that was great.
Yeah.
There are as many definitions of constructivism as there are people that practice it many times, and there are lots of books out there on Piaget that say contradictory things sometimes. Part of that's because it is so hard to read Piaget in the original. I mean, I have a collection of a lot of Piaget books, but they're all out of print. I have to go to used bookstores and pick them up, and then they're even hard to read. So it's really hard to find people that have actually read Piaget in his original writings. Many people have read second and third versions of people talking about Piaget. That's sometimes hard also, and so we end up with a lot of different understandings. But I think the general understanding is that active nature of the child that we have to focus on.
All right, Gene, thank you so much. This has been another wonderful conversation with you. Again, I'll say I envy your students. All right, thanks so much, Gene. I appreciate your time. This has been fun.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, thank you, Dr. Geist. Very, very interesting conversation, and I appreciate your time. It'll be interesting to see what people think about this episode. Okay, a couple of announcements. I'm going to start a monthly newsletter, so just once a month. And so on the site, if you haven't already, you may have already received it, because some people have signed up for email notification. But if you haven't, check out the site. There's a little widget on the left side. It says, sign up for my newsletter. And if you go in there and give me your email address, I will promise not to spam you, but to send you only a newsletter once a month. And it will contain some updates as well as more things like this. As you know, I've been talking a bit about, I love concept mapping, and I've been using the MeadMap program recently. And so I was just kind of going back and forth with the support people. I couldn't help but to tell them, I'd love to see this feature, and I'd love to see that one. And they've been responding very positively. And so I just thought to myself, I said, a lot of students and faculty listen to the psych files. So would you like to give us a promo code? And so they said, sure, here it is. Why don't you give this out? Basically, if you go to the MeadMap website, www.meadmap.com, if you don't have an account yet, there is a free account. And if you put in this code, which is MBRT0WQ3, which I know you're going to memorize, but if you don't, just go to the website, www.thepsychfiles.com, and I'll have this code in the show notes. Anyway, put in that code, and you will get an extra 2 months on a trial account. So no kickback to me here at all. I just asked them if they would, you know, give me a code, and they said, here you go. It's good for 250 people, so you might want to check that out as soon as you can. But if you do, if you hear this episode late and you'd still like to try it out, well, just send me an email and I'll try to squeeze another promo code out of them. Okay, but anyway, so those are the kinds of things I'd like to do. And, you know, every once in a while I pop a little, hopefully humorous, video onto YouTube, my YouTube channel. So there's various things other than the podcast that I'm doing. And I'd love to just send a a newsletter saying, hey, there's this and there's that and there's this. So if you're interested in psychology, come on over and check up and sign up for the newsletter. And I'll be happy to send you a quick newsletter every month. So there's that announcement. And of course, there's don't forget about the brain mnemonics. If you have a test coming up, if you're a student and you have a test on the bio-psych chapter, you might find these brain mnemonics very helpful. So that's the story. Okay, so check out the website, www.thepsychfiles.com. Okay, thanks for being a fan, and I will see you next time.